just peeked the side of my eye, saw the chat, and someone said the big black caucus is about to commence. And you already are starting off with a zinger for a very serious show. I don't know how I feel about that. Starting off with a zinger like that. Good morning to most, good afternoon to others, and good evening to the viewing audience across the pond. I am your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to a very important episode of This Is Revolution podcast. I grew up watching, in its latter stages, a show called Tony Brown's Journal, which was a black affairs show. And I was like, what if I had a Tony Brown's Journal, but more fun? So this is as close as I'm going to get tonight to my Tony Brown's moment. And I'm very excited about this, the subject matter, and of course the guests. But first, let me bring in my co-host, my homie, my dog, the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles.
I did let the thumbnail marinate for a while because I'm really proud of this one.
You're stoking all kinds of flames with the thumbnail already.
Are people mad about it? Because if so, then it's okay. Speaking of black prophetic fire, she is another Haitian on this show. She's also the voice of reason. Please welcome Mademoiselle Toussaint.
Hello, hello. Always good to be with you. I'm enjoying the yellow, Jason.
You're enjoying the cardigan?
Very nice.
It's a winter spring day here in Mexico. It was the most beautiful Friday I've ever seen. And then today, I'm crossing my fingers that I keep my power.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, infrastructure here. Coming in. Who, you know, this person actually, I don't want to say inspired the show, but it was very serendipitous. But I've been trying to put this show together for a while. Or this kind of show together for a while. I didn't know how to frame it. And then the sometimes why of TIR, he does have to keep his distance because he likes being employed. Please welcome Paul Prescott.
Good to be here. I am an advocate of full employment, so I do like keeping my job and everyone keeping their job.
Keep your distance. Just a safe distance.
By RuPaul.
And also the distance helps you from, you know, Umar Johnson and NOI beef. And that's what we're really trying to protect you from.
You are the black cash nationalist capital of the East Coast.
Is it?
Of the world. Not what? Is it Philly?
This or Newark? I think Newark may have.
I don't know. I feel like Chicago wants to tell you to hold their beer when it comes to that.
Well, the thing is, though, the thing about Philly had an entertainment version of Mojo. Black nationalists. Not, you know, Philly had the black Sounds of Philadelphia. Sounds of Philadelphia that kind of cooperated with, like, you know, do it yourself, get yourself together. We could do it, brothers and sisters. If we do it, we could try. Kind of ethos of the early 70s.
Which is my personal ethos.
You just walk around.
Maybe if you do it, take your time, do it.
That's how I say myself in the mirror every morning. I say that to myself. So
we can do it, baby. Another former resident of Philadelphia. He's becoming a staple on this show. You know him. You may know him from his articles in the New York Times and the Atlantic. Please welcome Bertram Cooper.
Hey.
I'm pretty disappointed that we're both wearing cardigans. I gotta say, that was not how I planned to start Saturday, shawl cardigan Saturday.
If it makes you feel any better, Bert, as you know, we had some back and forth this morning messaging. This cardigan was the last minute. It was either this or topless.
Ooh.
I was gonna go full Lenny Kravitz. And I didn't know if it was time yet.
Just shirtless, leather pants.
Biracial. No, just like, you know, like a denim vest, no shirt, you know, pants right above the mangina.
I'm glad you went with this.
There you go.
We are all happier with this.
Everybody wins. Everybody wins. But let's get back to what happened to the Black Revolution. This month marks the 52nd anniversary of the 1972 Gary Black Political Convention, a moment where vast sections of Black political thought convened to attempt to strategize a Black American politics for the 1972 presidential election. From our panel member and TIR Sometimes Why Paul Prescott's article in Jacobin Magazine, the Gary Convention was inspired by the changing nature of the Black civil rights struggle, the fulfillment of some of the civil rights movement's major legislative priorities, namely the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and Voting Rights Act of 1965, had unleashed new questions about the movement's future strategies and goals. Quickly, it became clear that equality before the law did not necessarily address the systemic issues most Black people faced in the realm of employment, housing, and education. Some trade union-oriented civil rights leaders like A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin proposed the continuation of a broad multiracial coalition to take on structural economic issues in the form of the Freedom Budget for All Americans. But for many others frustrated with the limitations of the civil rights legislation, Black power became the rallying cry from 1966 onward. Again, that is from Paul Prescott's article in Jacobin. If you're watching the show, we're definitely going to put links in the chat. We'll put links in the comments. And for the audio only listeners, there will definitely be a link to this in the description, as well as a link to Cedric Johnson's book From Revolutionaries to Race Leaders, which, as Pascal said earlier before we came on air, probably the best left critique explanation of maybe where we are now. That being said, oh, Pascal disappeared.
Yep.
Where'd he go?
There he goes.
There he goes. All that to change his shirt.
Same shirt.
I mean, he has a cardigan on now.
So, Pascal, what happened to our Black Revolution? I'll start with you.
I think that the Black Revolution faced something that most revolutions face, which is the inability to confound or to reconcile internal class stratification amongst revolutionaries. I mean, listen, when you have Richard Hatcher, and you have people coming out of the Congressional Black Caucus dealing with the Mary Barack Obama, Bobby Seale, and former members of the Black Panther Party. These people have different worldviews. Why is there an assumption that we're going to have one universal Black theology or ideology that's going to come out of a meeting of all those forces, and the ones that are not the most funded, the most wealth connected to the foundation world, the ones that are most experienced in PMC type skills because they have been working in the Great Society programs? Why are we not going to assume that they take the helm and the leadership and the direction of the agenda as opposed to those radical revolutionary cadre that may not have those experiences?
Paul?
I'll start by saying, I think a big question going forward from 1965, 1966 is like, what does it even mean, the Black Revolution? What does it mean? What are the goals? And 66, I think, is a very interesting fork in the road moment because at that time.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
The right mainstream people like Byron Russell, they actually were in agreement with the black nationalists like Stokely Carmichael, Charles Hamilton. They were in agreement that the civil rights legislation for urban blacks, you know, cities like Newark, Philadelphia, Chicago, all these places, like, it didn't really mean much to them to have a civil rights bill, because there it's sort of like we kind of already have that. So they both think that, you know, this civil rights legislation is limited, but the question is now, where do we go? And that's where the fork in the road, where you have Randolph and Rustin kind of advocating, we need a, not really a black revolution, but a more full-scale revolution in the society for employment, care, for universal health. And then on the other side, you have the black power idea of like, well, we need community control, which can mean a lot of different things. And really, black power kind of remains very vague, and different people and different organizations kind of try to fill in the blanks of what that could mean. But I think, you know, it was a failure to kind of transition to a more full-scale, comprehensive revolution that would have to, I mean, I would argue, include a broader coalition than just a black revolution. But I mean, to Pascal's point, I mean, the cleavages started to emerge. I mean, from 1960 to 1970 alone, the black middle class doubles. During that same period, you all of a sudden, you now have black mayors of major cities, black congresspeople, you have the creation of the Congressional Black Caucus. So inevitably, there's going to be divergences in strategy. Not to mention, I mean, a lot of broader structural factors kind of outside of black activist control, such as the industrialization and a lot of talk about that.
Hey, Bert, what happened to the Black Revolution, Bert? What happened to your Wi-Fi, Bert?
My Wi-Fi seems fine, but if the camera gets distracting, I'll just turn the shit off.
It's fine. It's just some Max Headroom shit.
I think the, you know, looking at the moment I read Paul's piece, and as I'm going through it, it's just, you know, what happened to the revolution? It's, for me, it's, they never conquer, or they never get over the class fractures, because if you're looking at it from the perspective of, you know, the black middle and upper class, they seem to succeed pretty well at what they would like to do. You know, just to put some actual numbers on it, looking at household income in 1972, when the convention is happening, just 1.2% of black households are above the $150,000 a year mark. You come up to 2022, and that's up to 12% of black. So it's a massive increase of black households, you know, over 10%, making over $150,000 a year. Obviously, you have the expansion of the black middle class. But in terms of, you know, the coalitional movement, as democratic politics, you know, moves by the decade, they overall managed to cut the poor out just across the board. You know, black Democrats today, they don't have any inroads. They don't really seem to want them with, you know, the greater swath of white poor. So that's not really a constituency they have to deal with. In terms of the black poor, they mostly, you know, quoting that from revolutionaries to race leaders idea, they can deal with purely the black middle and upper class to be representative of black folks. And everyone can imagine that automatically means being in affiliation with the black poor. But obviously, we know in this show that that's not really how it works. So just poor folks in general get cut out of this. And so getting back to, you know, the agenda at the Gary Convention, it's who is going to care most about whether or not there's affordable housing, whether or not there's good transportation infrastructure, whether or not there's full employment. It's mostly going to be these lower working class and black folks in poverty, and they just get left behind. They don't have a lot of say as black politics moves, you know, decade by decade. And, you know, if you're looking at it from the perspective of the black middle and upper class, they continue to be succeeding in their particular neoliberal goals. I mean, if you were to look up master's degree attainment right now and separated by race, like 13% of the master's degrees handed out like 3 years ago were going to black folks, which is very close to perfect representation. So data part is split along class lines, or the project split across class lines, and black, poor, and lower working class were left out.
Pascal, you want to add on that?
Well, I definitely think there were profound class cleavages in terms of the results that come about after these movements, right? Because part of the problem is that the remedies that are suggested as a consequence of this movement era is really based on increasing leadership at the top in terms of, you know, the, you know, affirmative action, minority genocide programs, things of that nature. These are things that are going to be designed to help improve the quality of life of Black people at the top. But at the same time, don't forget we're having an increase of mass incarceration, deindustrialization, and a few things at the bottom. So there's no question that there's going to be a class fracture that includes increases in the Black community. But my question is that why are we expecting Black politics to be able to effectively handle that? And we're still assuming that there's going to be a unified Black political front after that. And that's part of the problem, is that the assumption that the unified Black political front is going to be able to assume to handle the problems of 42 million Black people is the problem.
Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say two things. I mean, the first thing was, I mean, something we just have to acknowledge is that, as it turned out, Black power was perfectly compatible with being incorporated without a revolution. And this is where, I mean, Cedric's book from Revolutionaries to Race Leaders gets into this, but the first official Black power conference was in Newark in 1967. They had conferences in 68 and 69. And you look at the platforms they produce, you know, demands like community control, demands like buy Black campaigns, more Black politicians, you know, and this is why I kind of constantly come back to, why do we necessarily view Black power as more radical than some of the mainstream civil rights movements? So a lot of it was perfectly compatible with the system without necessarily a revolution. The other thing I'll say, I think, which is interesting, when it comes to the Black political class that participated in the Gary Convention, so some of these mayors, these Black Congress people, you know, and this is part of how politics has just shifted to the right, the center of gravity. But if you look at these first Black politicians, a lot of them were, by standards of today, very good. I mean, you know, they were advocating social democratic policies. They came out of civil rights and labor, these sort of things. And their argument out of Gary, which I think we should give a lot of credence to, was like, you know, look, we actually have constituencies. The Congress of African Peoples, which was Amiri Baraka's organization, what exactly is their base? It's not really clear. We have a constituency we actually have to respond to. And I think another thing going against them was, again, the structural factors. And they made a very astute point, was like, you know, you want to talk about community control, but at the end of the day, the issues affecting Black people in cities are not city level institutions. So yeah, let's take over the school district. I mean, look, Philadelphia right now, the whole school board is Black, but the funding that actually would make schools, you know, humane and how they should be comes at the state and federal level. So you want to focus on like institutions of the ghetto. And Gary Hatcher, who was mayor of Gary, made a very good point of like, you know, at the end of the day, I actually don't really control the jobs and the resources for my constituents. Like, these things are really at the federal level. These are in the hands of corporations. So, but a lot of these mayors, it was kind of bad timing as well. They came in to power right as, you know, these jobs are leaving the inner city, there's less federal funding. So in a way, it was very bad timing for them to be able to fulfill the agenda that they wanted to.
It's mayors of these cities like Gary. Where else was there a Black mayor?
Newark.
These were former industrial hubs, if I'm not mistaken, correct? So these guys are coming in right at the time where all these places, these jobs are leaving in these cities. Why are these cities so dominated by Black people, population wise?
The Great Migration.
It
was the Great Migration, right? The Great Migration that takes Black people after. Don't forget, there's two Great Migrations. You have the first wave of the Great Migration that goes forth from the early 20th century up until World War II. And this is the second great revolution that goes after World War II up until the late 60s as well. So we have these two periods of times where you have black people who are moving in large numbers from the South into the Northeast, into the Midwest, into major urban areas, trying to find a better way of life than they were finding in the agrarian South, where they were relegated to sharecropping and domestic labor.
Throw out there for my own, home state of New Jersey, that when black folks are moving up from the South and also trying to get into the suburbs, especially during post-World War II, like suburb boom, places like New Jersey, and I'm sure a lot of other states have similar processes like this, but New Jersey multiple times went to the state Supreme Court whether or not you had to allow low-income housing, particularly for black folks. It's a fight that starts in like the 1950s with a woman named Ethel Lawrence. And it just goes decade after decade where they find different ways to block low-income housing. But one of the rules they eventually came up with, at least in New Jersey, was one town could sell its share of the low-income burden to another town. And cash-strapped towns like Newark, Camden, places that kind of lost money after, they stopped being industrial hubs, they were willing to buy the low-income housing burden from the surrounding areas. But it just annihilated their tax base. So that's why, at least in places like New Jersey, you have a lot of towns where it's just all the poor people seem to be there. But it's because they were willing to take money to take on more of the poor folks in the surrounding areas.
Paul, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just kind of going back to what Pascal said. I mean, he's right. I mean, the fundamental flaw in this Gary project was this idea that there could be this unity. And the slogan was unity without uniformity. And I think that was a way for them to kind of try and justify that. Like, well, yes, we're not going to all do the same thing, but we have this broad-based unity. And I think, Baraka was motivated by this because he was involved in an effort in Newark to elect the first black mayor, Kenneth Gibson. And there, and I think in many areas, there was kind of this interesting dynamic where you had these, so-called radical black nationalists interacting with more mainstream figures and getting people elected. So I think he had this idea that we can take this model in Newark and create this broad unity nationally. And in a sense, I mean, the Gary Convention was impressive. I mean, you have Coretta Scott King with Betty Shabazz, with radical black nationalists who call them Marxists, with members of the Congressional Black Caucus. I mean, it'd be hard to kind of imagine that gathering happening today. So in that sense, you look at it and it's like, wow, this is impressive. But once you start getting into the details, you just can't paper over these divisions. And, they produced this black agenda out of Gary. And, you can look at it and there's a lot of very great things in there, national health care, full employment, public transit, every kind of thing you would want in there, anti-imperialist things. But again, there's a fundamental contradiction where it includes things that are pro-integration, mainstream civil rights things. And then on the other hand, it also says, we also want to create five black states and, some elements that are.
Where were the black states?
I forget.
It just comes out of the Republic of New Africa.
It includes elements that kind of show, like, we believe that we can change the system, and also elements that are like, no, the system's gone. We got to do our own thing. So it's like, okay, you can create this agenda, and it kind of looks impressive, and it's smart people writing this stuff, but you can't operationalize it. And it's kind of showed as soon as the convention ended, the Congressional Black Caucus people were like, well, let's create our own platform that's kind of the same, but a little bit watered down. And there's also this idea that we're going to go into the 1972 presidential election with a unified strategy. Again, kind of immediately broke down. I mean, Jesse Jackson was at Gary calling for an independent black political party. A few months later, he's at the DNC campaigning for McGovern. But again, it kind of was just based on this assumption, we can achieve this unity. Just put all the important black people in a room and it's going to be great. And it just couldn't work out that way. There were too many differences, ideological differences, class differences, and you just can't paper that over after a certain point.
Well, let's not be like the Gary Convention, and let's let one of the women here speak. Toussaint.
Yes, sir.
Would you like to add something there?
I agree with Paul and Bertrand and Pascal.
But not Pascal?
A little bit with Pascal.
Damn. Okay, what do you disagree with Pascal? This is your Shirley Chisholm moment.
It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be.
Poor Tiffany had a coffee cup in her hand and a cigarette in the other.
Anybody watch the
I don't want to go on a tangent here, but that movie's horrible.
I haven't watched it.
Just horrible. And of course, like, you know, it's going to be horrible going in, but I kind of don't even want to go there. But I will mention this. So the issue of Shirley Chisholm hung over the convention a little bit because she was running the same year.
President.
Yeah, she was running for president. Now, you know, the people of the Congressional Black Caucus, I mean, even many of the Black nationalists did not support her. There's different interpretations of why. I mean, I kind of go through in the piece. Throughout 1970 and 1971, there were a lot of gatherings in the lead up to Gary that were very similar, very broad. I mean, you know, they had a gathering in Atlanta that included Amir Baraka's Congress of African Peoples, but also the NAACP, the Southern Christian Leadership Council. And Chisholm didn't really participate in these pre-convention gatherings. And so for many people, they were like, well, she's not really a part of this process. She's not really, you know, so we don't want to support her. Now, Chisholm would say, well, they weren't going to support me anyway because they didn't like me and they were sexist. I mean, I think there's probably truth in both. But she wasn't even able to get the support of the Black political establishment and activists. And there was also this thought about her, you know, whether legitimate or not. I can't really say. I mean, I'm not an expert on Shirley Chisholm, but that was she was more a candidate of the white feminists than of Black people. I mean, that was a dynamic. That's
damn.
Sorry,
Shirley.
I mean, the movie, I think if you go into the movie watching it as comedy, I mean, it's pretty bad. I mean, I don't want to make this about that. I'll leave it there.
I haven't seen it.
Paul throwing out bombshells.
Yeah, man.
I'm just saying what we're saying.
Reading Paul's piece was like really cool for me because I'm not as familiar with the Gary Convention. I mean, the slogan was very intriguing, just the unity without uniformity, because very often what I feel like the Black leadership class pushes forward is this very naive uniformity that naive unity that just imagines that the best way to get ahead is for us all to pretend that there are no fracture lines. But, you know, that this was happening in 1972, and we've had other, you know, conversations on this as a revolution. And you see a little bit of that in the quote that Paul has from like Jesse Jackson, where you're already seeing that kind of pull up your pants mentality coming from him. We've got the slums inside of us. And it's just, it's really interesting for me to think of this, the progressive part of this policy platform happening in 1972, but you're just about to get into this moment that, at least for me, when I look at the history, you know, late 70s and then all throughout the 80s, the fracture lines between like the Black poor and the Black working class, the lower part of it that lives right outside of you know, the worst parts of the ghetto, I'll say, like that fracture gets just cracked wide open, like really, really, really big in the 1980s. And, you know, this whole policy of just putting forward this idea of unity between these two groups, when in fact, you know, the working class and the Black poor disagree on their value set just completely, you know, later in the 70s, then in the 80s. And then in terms of the Black poor folk who might have really wanted to spearhead a lot of these progressive platforms, to Pascal's point, you know, starting like from 1979 to 1982, at least in that sample, like if you're talking about Black males in the poorest subset, like one out of every four or five ends up in prison. By the time the 30s, the carceral state just eviscerates them. And then as you're following that generation over time, Black women, they just face like the eviction crisis at its staunchest. And when they follow people from like one eviction to their second, participate in community level politics just drops with each eviction that people experience. so that you end up with these neighborhoods of poor black folks who are at odds with the working class or the, you know, black small business owner. Plus they have these records of being imprisoned, and they have the eviction problems, and they're being displaced from one community to the next, so they don't feel close to their neighbors. And it's just, it's hard to imagine how you could have had more unity with all these other structural factors happening.
Toussaint.
Yes.
You can't hire Shirley Chisholm.
I'm on mute and everything.
Yeah, I know. I know. I can see you trying to hide. And I know you're trying to do your magic in the chat, but the chat is off the rails as usual. So you have to just let that train go off the track, and you cannot pick it up. Pick it up.
Chat has some on point fashion talking points today.
Yeah, there's a few douchers in there.
I cannot believe people's obsession with button counts in this. I didn't know that this is such a popular topic.
Bert, it's because I disregard buttons, and if it's not down to your navel, then why did you even wear the shirt in the first place?
Well, that's because, you know, you take all of your inspiration from, like, you know, 70s pimps.
You're right. You're right.
It was the fashion at the Gary convention, actually.
I would have walked to the Gary convention. Just
like, I bet the Gary convention was balling. I would love to see that.
Players hustle. Players you see the players ball from, like, you know, the Mac, or the pimps convention, when the pimps come in with the, you know.
We can't look, if people are watching this show and all of a sudden you're talking about the Mac and players ball.
Very contemporary. Very
good. Toussaint, what is the fascination with this idea of black unity?
I think the idea is that we need unity to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people get unity and conformity confused.
I'm sorry. Steve just jumped in the chat with.
Okay, good.
I was not mad at you. I'm going to go ahead and put Steve's comment on the screen. Steve says, yo, I just checked in. How did Pascal pass the paper brown test for today's big black panel?
His mama's light skin.
His mama's light.
That's actually true.
But you and Pascal both come from New York, and you come from, you know, nice middle working class neighborhoods of New York. So you're even growing up in a time where you don't even understand unity, or do you think in unifying black terms?
Well, that's a really good question, my friend, because the concept of what black unity ends up being is not unity, but it's a uniformity in terms of ventriloquism, because what happens is that you have a certain segment of black people speaking for everyone else. And I think you asked a very good question. What is all this black unity about? I think black unity stems from the fact that there's an assumption that white people all work together in oppressing black people. And I think it underestimates the amount in which capitalism segments poor white folk away from white folk who have capital and power as well. And that this idea that all white folk are in it together to try to screw black folk over, I think is a naive realization of how the system actually works.
Where do you think that comes from, though, that this idea that white people all work in unison to make sure that they have a foot in a black man's ass?
I mean, I think that's a very easy realization to come. Listen, let's not act like we don't have, not only after, you know.
Well, hold on for a second. Let me rephrase it. Where does that mentality come from today?
Oh, that's a bad
Let's point. Not look at 1972 lens, because that's going to make a little more sense, because you're going to have so many people that have grown up in a Jim Crow reality, in a segregated reality. Everyone on this screen here, not one of us, has grown up in any sort of segregation that's been state sanctioned. Why still the idea of unity? You know, Bert, You grew up a little different.
I mean,
you know, but and let me preface this by saying people love to say kind of they think it's funny. They go, oh, he's too light. He's too this to ever have known X, Y, and Z. And it's like, no, he grew up in abject poverty. I won't get into all the details, but you definitely understand a different idea of unity and Black unity than most people, right?
So, you know, yeah, I'm going to be 36 very soon. When I was growing up, and this is now contentious, but when I was growing up, it was the one drop rule was what I was advised of. And that's what every like Black elder told me. I mean, the fact that I was light was a reason to remind me, like, you're still a nigga to all these white people. You're always being a nigga to the cops. It gets very much to like, you know, the Jack Johnson quote of like, I'm Black and they never let me forget it. Yeah, I'm Black and I never let them forget it. Like, that was what they thought would be protective, you know, in their understanding of the world. The one drop rule is what was in effect. Black unity, you know, coming from poor Black neighborhoods, it was pushed us as like a political strategy. Like, I can tie this into, you know, being mixed. 2000's the first year that they have a multiracial category, or at least they considered putting it on the census. Mm-hmm. But the year prior to that, the NAACP had gone out to Washington to argue against adding a multiracial category because really? They were really, it's, I want to say it's Harry McDougal for NAACP, their Washington branch. He goes out there and argues against it. And this isn't just Black folks. The Asian organizations did the same, where they didn't want any sort of biracial or mixed category either, because they wanted to strictly play the numbers game. And when you're poor, and you know, you're seeing Black politics, and it's mostly, you know, 91, 92, 93, 94. It's this, you know, cavalcade of older civil rights leaders, people like Jesse Jackson. This unity strategy is just supposedly, if we all vote the same way, we can get a little bit, you know, better shit from like white people. But you look at it kind of like, you don't, poor people across the board, across the race, don't really trust politicians too much. And that was one experience of Black unity. But then as I'm coming up, you know, in the 2000s and the 2010s, when we say like all the white people are out to get Black folks, at least in its early incarnation, we didn't really mean all the white folks. It's not how it was pitched. It was that white males were out there just having a ball. Just all of them were basically millionaires and billionaires, and they were fucking up the world for everybody. And for a lot of other white folks, particularly, you know, college educated white women, this was a good pitch. This was a good thing to write about in academic journals. This was a good thing to write about in newspapers and magazines, and to basically say like, yes, 100%, that is the best explanation for why the world is the way it is. White males had fucked everything up. And all the rest of us are over here, having to deal with that. And, you know, saying that all Black folks were facing the same thing became kind of like this way of acknowledging whiteness or white supremacy, but it was a very safe acknowledgement of it. It worked very well, again, for like white women to be like, all Black people face white supremacy. But they were saying that the same way that they're clawing up the corporate ladder themselves. So I'm probably not explaining the best way, but I think this idea of Black unity is just very effective for leadership, whether it's white leadership or Black leadership. It's just an idea that they like to pitch. It works for them.
Pascal?
No, I mean, I think there's some truth to that. I mean, definitely it maintains this hegemony of power. And also it's easier to maintain a politics of containment in which you limit the options of Black voter participation, and that you make Black people feel like they have to, oh, we have to all sit together to fight against, you know, the oppressor and the man. And I mean, I think it's a very limited politics, because I think in the end, what it ends up doing is very much circumscribing the political choices that Black voters get to opportunism.
I mean, did you see a link between yourself and the poor neighborhoods that man had a bunch of Black people in it, you and Toussaint? Because you guys come from a similar area, right?
Well, you know, one of the things you know about New York is that even if you grew up in a middle-class neighborhood, the proximity to poverty is not far. Like, you can live in, like, a nice middle-class Jamaica Queens neighborhood, and you can be in the bus and people from the projects are on the bus with you, or people from the like the real hood in the projects are taking the
bus. Me and Bert call that hood adjacent. And there's when you're hood adjacent, this is just my opinion, and if it sounds offensive, oh well. When you're hood adjacent, it's a huge difference from being in the hood, because hood adjacent means you can pretend to have all of the hood problems and get some hood respect, but not really have to deal with real hood problems. Right.
Oh, I'm not trying to argue like I don't want to be dealing with hood problems.
I'm not saying that to you. I'm saying it to, in general, because I have a deep-rooted disdain for the hood adjacent Negroes that love to act as if their life was the life of the people that live, like you said, two blocks down the way.
Oh no, there's a big. I mean, listen, there's a big difference in black communities between what you call working class black people and black people who are what is called the black underclass. They don't live. They live different kind of qualities of life. And one of the realizations of trying to flatten out black life is the attempt to try to make it seem like all black people are poor together. This is one of the, another reason why I have a problem with this quote unquote ADOS FBA nonsense. Is that it tries to make this notion that all black people are all in the same economic position, when in reality there are different levels of black people who are different in different positions of economic precarity. And lots of black people are poor and working class. Some black people have benefits. Some black people actually have pensions. So there's different ways of looking at the quality of life. So I don't disagree with that at all.
Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a really interesting question. Like, why does this idea of black unity persist despite the empirical reality being so different? I don't really have the full answer to that. I mean, I do think partly, yes, there is not state-sanctioned segregation, but there's still a lot of de facto residential segregation. I think that kind of maintains that a little bit. It's also reinforced all the time, I think, by like urban black political machines. Black politicians still emphasize this ideologically. Our whole world, all the funding that now is going to kind of propping up this kind of thinking. I just don't know how much of it is just inertia that we keep reaching back to the past, to this idea. It didn't even make sense in 1972, but it made a lot more sense then than it does now. I can't fully explain why this keeps persisting. And often, when you talk to people on an individual level, it's like they'll say the slogan, but then when you start talking about real things or in more detail, you kind of find out, well, they don't actually believe this. I mean, I think some of that went on in Gary is like everyone's saying the thing, but then their actions immediately show they don't actually take that to its full conclusion. There was an interesting moment that kind of just at the convention that shows the contradictory nature of everything, where Richard Hatcher, again, the mayor of Gary, he was someone that had credibility with the radical black nationalists, even though he was a politician, but in his speech, he says like, and yeah, we want to build a movement even with working class and poor whites. And he gets booed, not by everyone, but he gets booed a lot during that. A lot of the mayors, when they went back to their districts and had to win elections, they didn't operate in the sense of just purely black unity. They kind of understood they had to build a coalition. I mean, there's just no way they could get elected without that. But I don't fully know why this idea persists when the reality is just like it keeps getting more and more different than this just like flat black experience.
I would throw out there, like, if we're expanding the lens outside of just black folks, like a unity strategy, whether or not you call it that, is what all the groups that are marginalized in the US, or at least claim marginalization, they all use that same strategy. And you watch that break down at different points for them. But all of them use this slogan strategy where that was what LGBTQ used. That is what women had That is, you know, obviously what Black folks have had, it's what Hispanic folks have had, it's what Asian folks attempt as well, is always this unity strategy, and we're all in this together against some external force. And then as we go through time, obviously it's never true. Some groups are better at acknowledging the lack of truth there than others, but, you know, throughout, probably from like 2014 on, and it dips and goes up, but you know, prominent feminists were dealing with the fact that, you know, starting like 2014, not really starting there, but you would have women like Lena Dunham or Kate Winslet or Anne Hathaway going and speaking on behalf of all women. And you started having people push back against that and talking about, you know, the class differences between people, like Sheryl Sandberg talking about like lean in. Mm-hmm. And that became like a national discussion because, of course, it wasn't true. Even among just white women, there were all of these different class effects. And at the same time, Lena Dunham was talking about all women. There were white women over here who were dealing with, you know, deaths of despair, opioid crisis, so forth. Gay folks dealing with the same thing. You see this a lot in like movies like Bros and whatnot, where, you know, there's these massive class differences that they allied. And then there's also racism that they allied. I'll round it out with Asian folks. You know, a lot of Asian groups and a lot of Asian politics, it's run primarily by East Asians, whereas like, you know, the gangsters fuck Asians that like Jason grew up with aren't really you're not getting a bunch of Laos, Cambodian, Hmong. They're not the faces of things like, you know, the fight against affirmative action policy. So whatever it is about American marginalized politics, this is the strategy that everyone thinks works. Maybe it's just the occasional psychological wages of seeing somebody who looks like you get some cool shit or own a basketball team or whatever the fuck. I don't know, but all of these groups subscribe to this policy.
Mm. One of the things that I wanted to mention in terms of the concept of the need for a Black unity is that there's a degree of kind of social prescription in this, in that if you look at the marketing of media to various ethnic groups, a lot of this kind of like black collective interest stems also from the fact that you have target marketing and target programming and target interests coming out of Black network programming, Black televised program, Black music institutions. So what happens is that there's a whole cultural, pop culture, social cultural phenomenon of Black interests as well that go into creating this sense of we have our own kind of thing that's different from everyone else. So I think that part of it is not only a political kind of reality, but also it's a kind of culture industry phenomenon that you see spill over into a political worldview as well.
And here's a question, you know, as we're coming up on the hour, and I want to actually thank all you gentlemen for taking the time early this morning, even you guys on the East Coast. I know everyone likes to sleep in on the weekends, so I appreciate that. Pascal said on his first appearance on this show, it's been kind of a theme of this show, that Black power has succeeded culturally where it has failed politically. Do you think that there are still important figureheads in Black politics, i.e. the Obamas and the culture industry, that don't mind that narrative and see that narrative as a win? And if this is the winning narrative strategy that wants to be portrayed, will not just Black people, but the left in general, continue to lose to the right? Who wants to go first? Bert Cooper.
You know, in terms of Black power, Black unity, all that, you know, winning culturally, I think that I think it did have a lot of what people consider wins. They felt very, you know, you use Barack Obama as an example. People felt like that was this cultural win, getting to see Jay-Z take ownership of sports teams. That was considered a cultural win. A lot of these things are considered cultural wins. I don't know the best way to describe this, but that Black Power, I'll call it like a strategy where you are able to leverage, you know, Black history to tell the public, like, we need this other cultural victory to keep moving things forward. We need, you know, more Black folks behind the camera. We need more Black showrunners. We need more Black studio heads. You know, being able to do this, it is getting to this point that you've seen with some other groups that have done this, where it's morphing a little bit, where people are starting to feel like even that is not a rich resource of leverage anymore, that there's less to go around. And I'll give kind of an example, you know, for Gen Z, we always make jokes about being like light-skinned on this and biracial folk. But for Gen Z, they really are kind of considering
privilege. Yeah.
Yeah. They're moving away from the one drop rule and going harder and harder into colorism. And they're going to a place where pretty soon will be like, okay, it's only a cultural win if somebody who's mid, you know, brown to like truly dark gets this shit. And it keeps going. And it's, I don't have a name for this phenomenon, but it's kind of how you saw like gay politics got to a certain point, and then they were like, but gay white males are basically straight, so we need to push them out. Now the cultural wins are for like lesbians and this.
We need a woman with suspenders on. That's what we need. Yeah.
And then we got to push them out. And it's really like, it's only a win for the queer community if it's, say, somebody who's trans or somebody who's non-binary. Something about this strategy as a resource for leveraging, you know, the majority for cool cultural shit, it's being treated as if it's getting scarce and people are finding ways to make the circle of people who can benefit, say, from, you know, Black Power wins smaller, if that makes sense.
Let's go.
Wow, that says a great deal. That about, for first of all, the phenomenon of Generation Z trying to leverage professional entree into the ruling class by color as opposed to by race is a very interesting tell in terms of where the ideology of race is in America. In other words, it's not enough that you're a fair complexion biracial Black person who benefits from DEI and gets that corporate job. You've got to be someone who's got that kind of like, you know, wide nose, certain lip complexion kind of makeup to be able to make that a call for victory. All of this various rendering of identityism doesn't deal with the ultimate realities that we haven't had a working class politics in America since the New Deal, since the Great Depression. And we definitely haven't had a working class Black politics in America. And I think that the bottom line is that unless we have a working class politics in this country, there will never be a politics that's going to deal with working poor and working class. It's going to deal with the issues of poor and working class Black people.
Paul?
Yeah, there's a lot. Well, I think where I'll go with this, I mean, I agree that I think that is a narrative that Black power won culturally. And it's true to many extent. And I think the difference between me and Obama is Obama would say, and that's a really important victory. And that's something we have to keep continuing. So there's like a self-justifying forever into the future. We need to keep getting more Black culture circulated. I mean, you do wonder, is there going to be a point where it doesn't impact people as much? I mean, we're reaching a point where it's like, it's normal.
Do you think we're there though, Paul? I mean, I feel like we're there. I feel like we're seeing kind of the last
most ordinary people. You know, and that's where it's like people can get lost in not realizing probably a lot of ordinary Black people aren't caring as much about this stuff. But to kind of what Pascal, I mean, something I wanted to bring up, I mean, about the working class politics. I mean, something really interesting I found, I was a little surprised by my research and I included it in the article. Harold Cruz, very interesting figure. I mean, if Cedric Johnson were on, he could say a lot more. You know, Harold Cruz, it's like one thing he'll write, I really think is really perceptive. Other things he'll write, I'm like, I don't know what the fuck he's talking about. But it was interesting he included this because he was someone that I think would kind of identify as one shade of Black nationalist. But he wrote an article about the 1974 Black political convention, which was smaller and didn't get as much attention. And he basically wrote, you know, he read Black Power by Carmichael and Hamilton, And he was shocked that they dismissed the idea of blacks working in coalition. And they talked about the populace, but he's like, how could you not talk about the New Deal, where blacks were loyal part of that coalition, and because they got stuff out of it. And he said, you know, there was a lot learned from that period that influenced, you know, the 60s. And I think, you know, that's kind of where Gary fell apart. It was kind of trying to replace the New Deal coalitional politics with this idea of just, you know, shallow black unity. And, you know, the last thing I want to say, I mean, it's very tempting, and there's like a popular interpretation on the left out there that, you know, the Gary Convention was sold out by the black political class. Its radical potential was like sold out by them. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I think a lot of the black politicians there were probably cynical actors, you know, were opportunistic, but I think that interpretation is a cop-out. I think it doesn't acknowledge that the strategy itself was flawed and not viable. I think it doesn't acknowledge that I think it's true that black politicians had more of a base among black people and were more in tune with what they wanted, which was not necessarily an African style liberation revolution, but, you know, maybe something more modest. I think it fails to acknowledge like the black nationalists didn't really build a base, you know, an actual constituency. So I think we should shy away from that kind of interpretation that it was sold out, you know, by the black politicians. They did it again. I think it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Pascal, do you want to add on that?
You know, one of the reasons that some people argue that the sellout was done was over the platform over certain international issues dealing with not only Pan-Africanism, but also Palestine, things of that nature as well. And one of the things that I find interesting is the role of internationalism, black internationalism, and how that played out in terms of the way in which black politics would become much more of a narrow navel gaze after the Gary Convention. That, don't forget, I'm old enough to remember in the 70s when black people would talk about foreign policy. They were interested in what's going on in the world, what's going on in Africa. There was a sense of Pan-Africanism. Whether we think it's bad or good, I'm not necessarily opposed to having a sense of internationalism amongst Americans overall. I think I can understand where third worldism becomes a problem, or the notion of just focusing on the third world becomes a left fetish, and that's problematic. But what happens when our version of the left gets stuck into being a kind of overly workerist, kind of like sock dem functionality of union organizing that divorces us from the fact that we're organizing these unions in, you know, kind of imperial hotbeds that are kind of exporting our goods and services to places that are doing some pretty bad and evil stuff? Do we just kind of become quiet? I've always wanted to ask Paul about that. How does internationalism work in the frame of a union left in your version of a democratic socialist kind of reality?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, we definitely have great examples from history. I mean, there's like the Harry Bridges and the communist aligned union leader of the dock workers refusing to load ships going to Germany, going to Nazi Germany, things like that. I mean, more recently, something encouraging is you have United Auto Workers coming out for a ceasefire. And, you know, they represent some Boeing workers, Boeing plants that make military weaponry. I do think it's a little different. I mean, if you were to break down how many unions and workers are involved in production that's like directly related to imperialism, I think it's relatively small section of the labor movement. But, you know, I mean, it's definitely an issue. I mean, in the Vietnam War, there were, over time, a coalition grew of unionists, which eventually included the auto workers, but people like Tony Mazzocchi led that. A. Philip Randolph was involved in opposing the war. So, I mean, it definitely is compatible. I mean, you've always had unions doing that. I mean, they've always, I think, been in the minority. And kind of, I mean, this is not directly related, but I'm glad you brought this up, because I think another thing I wanted to say was where I think black nationalists also went wrong. I think it was very good. You know, they made a contribution of increasing awareness of U.S. imperialism and imperialism in Africa, especially, and that's good. But I think they started to think, you know, looking at Guinea-Bissau and their united front against colonialism and thinking we can just take that structure and impose it on our situation in the United States among Black people when it was very different. And I think that also led to strategic errors. And I think it's sort of this, it is a balancing act of, again, I mean, so much of this comes back to like, you have to have a base, an actual working class base to be able to do anything. And I would argue, I mean, the best way to get that base is you've got to be focusing on the domestic issues that matter to people around their self-interest. So it's balancing that of being able to have this base, but also taking on these broader issues that might be harder, you know, that are not going to be an immediate self-interest tie-in, such as like fighting imperialism abroad. You can definitely make that argument and that tie-in, but again, I think if it drifts to becoming overly focused on foreign issues, it's just hard to create that mass base. Unless you have a situation, I mean, with the Vietnam War, I think it came down to the body bag and enough American soldiers dying and enough families having to consider that, that allowed for that mass base to grow. Whereas now we have these outsourced independent contractor wars where they can go on forever, but relatively few soldiers are dying, relatively smaller impact on our society. It just makes it really hard. You know, I sometimes hear people kind of like, what happened to the anti-war movement? Like, we suck. Well, it's like, you know, you had some of the largest protests ever before George Floyd in the lead up to the 2003 Iraq War. And the state said, fuck off, we're doing it anyway. And the official war ended quickly. You know, I think it's just a really big challenge. How do you maintain a movement where it's like drone warfare? You know, so I don't know. I'm a little less harsh on the U.S. anti-war movement because I think it's just a very different situation and a very hard to organize.
Do you think the people in it might be a little disillusioned by what they believe they saw in the 60s and 70s? Meaning that they... Yeah, you know, I think there's a narrative by boomers that this is how you defeat imperialism at home. It's just, you know, we put some flowers and some guns and we protested a little bit. And they really don't talk about the draft ending that much. There's never much talk about the Viet Cong.
Right. And even with Vietnam, it's like first of all, I mean, it took a long time. I mean, the war sadly went on for a long time, but it took a long time for them to grow to a critical mass. And even then, I mean, I think it's like most things in organizing. I mean, it's the classic Adolph Reed line. Like, if you win 3 out of 10 times, it's like baseball. You're a Hall of Famer if you get a hit 3 out of 10 times. So even the anti-war movement in Vietnam, it, I think, definitely impacted the war. It impacted their decisions, but it did not... I'll end the war. I think the North Vietnamese ended the war, kicking their ass enough or really being willing to withstand enough of an ass kicking long enough from us. But I think the anti-war movement definitely made a difference, but even that was not powerful enough, I think, ultimately to end the war. I think it contributed, but you're talking about, I mean, from the time it really got going, you could argue 65, I think that was the SDS march, to 75, you're talking about a 10-year period of constant mobilization. And, you know, but it's
64 is we have the self-immolations in 64.
There's
been two since last year. There's one that no one talks about for whatever reason that happened in the end of the year, 2023, lady lit herself a fire protest, and then the one that garnered a lot of attention that happened a month or so ago. But there was three that happened in 64, more religious based, but still. And that war doesn't end for about 10 years, 11 years.
And another powerful part, I mean, the organizing among GIs was really powerful and impactful. But again, I mean, again, this is where I'm not necessarily as harsh on the anti-war movement today. It's just, I think, a little harder to do that today without the draft, without the critical mass of soldiers dying. Obviously there are soldiers dying, there's a lot of PTSD and all that. Of course that's an issue, but it's just a different context that I think is more challenging to build that anti-war movement today.
I want to add this. Can I add this before you jump in, Bird, and then I'll shut up? Also, you know, which I think is important, what you just said, Paul. We have former GIs that come on this show. One hosts the Red Zone with me, Mike McGinnis, was not allowed to join his DSA chapter. They said, you're a former soldier of imperialism. You can't be here.
Are you serious?
As a heart attack. Similar things happened to Marcus and the rest of those left flank Vex guys. That's why they kind of formed their own little coalition. But is that a problem when we think about building broad coalitions that actually can bring more people in? I mean, there's nothing like seeing a soldier saying, this is wrong. And now I've learned why this is wrong, why we shouldn't do this. What's wrong with the Smedley Butler approach?
I mean, yeah, that is wrong and it's stupid. I mean, and also thinking about, of course, we know soldiers are disproportionately working class. I mean, that's kind of how they have done away with the draft of like, well, we'll give you some benefits, a lot of benefits that will really help. So join the military. And, you know, it's also, I mean, veterans are, I think, powerful, just like politically a powerful constituency. I mean, like, it's who's going to be going against a veteran, you know? What Republican politician is going to feel confident trashing veterans, you know, overtly? So, I mean, if you can build a movement of veterans, you know, they have, I think, a social power in our society. So to dismiss them is just, you know, idiotic. And again, I think one of maybe the more impactful figments or sections of the anti-Vietnam War movement was the GIs. I think that's when things got more serious. I think that's when the state took the anti-war movement made more serious. And also, I'll put it out there. I mean, I hesitate to say this because we're nowhere near an insurrectionist revolution. I think it's kind of stupid to even talk about, but it's just worth noting. I think any sort of successful revolution in history has involved the armed forces or a section of the armed forces breaking off at some point.
Yeah.
You kind of can't do it if all the people with the guns are against you. So I'll leave that there.
I agree. I'm sorry, Bert, I apologize.
Yeah, no worries. What I was curious about is just, you know, so in terms of coalitional politics, I don't think anyone can get anything done, you know, from this vantage point, or I don't think Black folks can get anything done without coalitional politics. In this case, right now, what's winning is not the one that we want, but there is a coalition between a certain segment of Black folks and a segment of, you know, liberal power brokers, and they are successful in getting their things done. Mm-hmm. With Black folks being, by definition, you know, a numerical minority, and with, you know, gerrymandering being what it is, without a coalition, you are just not moving anything. But what I'm curious about is, you know, when people use the big tent item or phrase of like working class, at one point, working class referred to a group of people who had to labor for a living, who were not going to have enough excess capital to purchase anyone else's labor. And they're living in a situation where we, you know, certain things about their material reality are true. For example, you're not going to get a 30-year mortgage loan. By that, I mean, you could only get loans that you had to pay back in 5 to 6 years. So it's just like, if you didn't have a certain job, home ownership was out of the question. Buying someone else's labor to like do your yard landscaping, out of the question. Coming to now, what I'm curious about is like, a lot of times I don't see working class, you know, thought of in dollars and cents. And that always raises questions for me, because I think of people, you know, the culture that forms around particular material realities. Like, you can be earning $30,000 a year and have a working class job. You can also be all the way up at 70, 80,000. If you're talking about people who maybe have three other general contractors working with them, you could be above that. You experience the same relationship to the means of production, but I'm not sure that tells you how to get along with each other in the room. I'm not sure that your material reality is the same and is making you value the same things. And just when I look at income data, the people whose relation to power or means of production could be described as working class, their incomes are way, way, it's a far greater range than what it was when that term working class came out. And so even if you have this section of working class, I still feel like that doesn't quite answer the questions of how all these people, you know, the dude making $40,000 a year living hood adjacent is over there with the person who might be living with nothing but other lawyer professionals, even though they're both technically working class based on means of production standards. Like, how, you know, where's the answer there?
Hip hop. There you go. Pascal, you want to expand on that?
That's a very interesting question. I don't have the actual immediate answer to that one.
Well, can you address the one on the screen? Please talk about the role of the Black Church in dampening responses to Vietnam. Thank you very much for your super chat.
I'm interested in the question. I'm not familiar with the Black Church's role in dampening the responses to Vietnam. Can anyone educate me onto that one? Are they talking about protests to the Vietnam War?
I can't say much. I mean, the only thing I'll say, I think, which you, Pascal, and others know, you know, when King first came out against the war in 67, I mean, not only did he face backlash in society generally, but from a lot of people in the civil rights movement.
And the church, that's true.
Including some of the, you know, Southern Christian Leadership Council were like, you know, this is not the time, people will hate you. So that did happen. I don't doubt at all that there were many Black churches that didn't want opposition to the Vietnam War, but I don't really know much more about that.
That's true. The National Baptist Convention did not support the civil rights agenda that was against the Vietnam War because of that. That's a fact.
Why'd you do that, Pascal?
I think that they did not want to lose popularity with the ruling class on the issue of Vietnam. And the civil rights agenda at that time had veered too far to the left.
Toussaint, would you like to add something?
It was actually just added, so.
Oh, can you add it again?
Can I add it again?
Sure.
In a full sentence?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well.
You just went from Shirley Chisholm to Condoleezza Rice. Just like,
Condoleezza?
Just like that, just bam.
Wow.
All these white women were about to have Toussaint bumper stickers. And all of a sudden, you're just a power broker for, you know, rich women.
Can I sidetrack something for a second? Sorry.
Sure.
I'm looking at some of these comments. And I'm sorry if this seems dense to all the wise viewers here. But the reason why I bring up that working class versus income questions, because when you're talking about coalitional politics, you're talking about people being in a room and actually getting along with each other and having some way of forming friendships and solidarity. And the reason why I look at it by income is because with our classes being as rigid as they are, a lot of times the person you're looking at who's making $40,000 a year from a working class job is the child from somebody who also made that amount. That is their culture. That is their neighborhood. That is what they know. And the same thing for the person at the other end of working class earning 70K, they're a lot of times the child of something in that. That's their culture. And so when these two have to actually become friends, for me, it just isn't enough to say like, well, me as the revolutionary, I just have to let them know that they both have the same relationship to the means of production and now they're dancing at each other's weddings. There's a gap for me. That's why I bring up the income, just because some of the commenters are like, well, clearly class and income are different. I'm worried how the actual friendships and common ground are formed and where the value systems are coming from. That's
And this is a great point because, I mean, when we talk about working class, we're talking about a very broad group of people. So including a McDonald's worker and maybe someone in the building trades or, I mean, a UPS driver, you could be making $100,000 a year as a UPS driver. So they're both working class, but I mean, they're material reality is different. I mean, I think this is where the unity would have to be forged in common political campaigns and political action. And I think this is where we miss out on not having something like a labor party or socialist party, where you could at least hold these two groups of people who are part of the same working class, but obviously very different experiences. You could hold them in the same party and forge some kind of common political action. And of course, you know, we know there's a lot of structural reasons why the United States is very hard to form that third party, but that's what we miss out on by not having something like a Labor Party, is to bring the class together, these different factions of it. I mean, one thing I will say, I think at least, you know, maybe someone who's a unionized worker who is making a really good wage, I think at least, again, because of their working class social network, they're probably still more likely to be in touch with people or know people who are working minimum wage or come out of that. You know, so I think there's at least some of those common bonds there. But I mean, that unity has to be built. We know the unity is latent, but it has to be built and actualized in struggle. I mean, that's the whole point.
No, I'm I appreciate that take, and that makes sense to me a lot. What raises questions for me is, you know, you said we need, you know, somebody, we need a party in a space that is doing this. We need that movement. And I know that there's little pockets or little examples of this, but, you know, a lot of times I will see people talk as if it's already come to fruition, as if there's already this working class consciousness that's been built out, and, you know, politicians just have to speak to that. And I just always raise eyebrows at that, because I'm like, I'm not sure that those social bonds have been built yet. But I do think, to your point, if there was such a space, they would have more commonality with each other. They'd at least, you know, they'd be working on it. It would make a difference.
Pascal, you want to add something?
Someone said, but kill black unity, right? You don't have working class unity, but kill black unity.
I didn't know there was black unity.
Yeah, you can't kill an imaginary creature. I'm not over here slaying.
I didn't know that. Maybe that's the same thing that when you go searching for unicorn horns. Is where you find black unity.
But this is what was kind of interesting about Bernie, is that with even without,
he was black unity personified.
Yeah, he was the right. He was Gary convention personified, but you know, even without the kind of former groundwork going, it was shocking just someone going out there and preaching this working class thing. I mean, you know, this broad anti-corporate thing did have the effect of galvanizing people around that agenda. And, you know, I remember the top donors of his campaigns, it was like truck drivers, Starbucks workers, construction, which kind of at least showed the potential. Where, yeah, obviously it's not like everyone's just out there with this perfect consciousness, but I think there is this broad anti-corporate sentiment. People know they're getting fucked. They know the rich are getting richer. So there is something to speak to, but again, it's not as simple as just saying the right words and everyone's going to fall in line.
Well, let's end with this very good question. Someone asked at Toussaint's on the screen for free. Just kidding. Totally kidding. I'm totally kidding. Thank you very much for your question, Cleveland Rocks. Is black unity desirable? I think that question, me personally, is extremely vague. And I don't know.
I always say, which
there's black people in my own family I don't agree with that's blacker than the Ace of Spades that I don't get along with. So why all of a sudden is just every Negro between California to Maine and I supposed to get along and sing Kumbaya? That's always confused me. But Pascal, you preach.
I've always wanted to say, which blacks do we want to unify? On what ground? On what politics? I don't want, there's lots of Negroes I don't want to unify with because their politics are garbage. I think the actual unity does not need to be limited to the actual race, but to the actual agenda of the politics.
Bert's gone. Bert Cooper has left the building. Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I think Pascal said it perfectly. And also, you know, I mean, I think whenever there is so-called black unity, I think it's going to be the middle and upper classes that essentially define what that is in reality. So I guess the short answer is no, it's not desirable, but it's not really possible. And again, I think it should be around the agenda. Like, you know, sure, if you take the overwhelming number of Black people who are working class, yeah, I want them to be united, but around, I think, it's the agenda that would advance their interests.
Bert?
I mean, I got a second what Paul said overall, and Pascal. In my reading of history, I just, whenever you make the unifying factor just something that broad, just if you're Black, we're with you, that maintains all of the other, you know, undesirable power structures outside of that one category label. I mean, I just, historically, if you're Black and some other type of marginalization, the Black unity principle just doesn't work that well for you. So if you're Black and a woman, if you're Black and gay, if you're Black and poor, it doesn't help you out. So I just don't have much faith in just Black unity. I would much prefer to be looking at some other unifying principle.
Well, we Condoleezza.
Are you serious?
No, not at all.
Thank you.
I'm not even this much serious. Number one, I'm not that serious because when I go to the East Coast, I don't want you showing up and slapping the shit out of me.
It's a possibility.
It is a possibility. You will jump up on a chair just to do it.
You're not 5'10".
You're not that tall. There you go. Take that. Oompa Loompa. Don't be fucking yelling at me. Don't go into the light, Carol Ann. So Toussaint, Black unity.
Black unity. What is it good for?
What is it
good? Don't say the next line of that song.
Who does she become after she says the next line of that song? She's already Condoleezza Rice. So after that, you just morph into Ellen.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Don't laugh at that, Paul.
I'm definitely getting the Oompa Loompa slap. Toussaint, seriously. Black, female, Haitian, under 5'3 unity.
Under 5'3 unity.
I think
it's something that we're told that we need. I do think it has to do with ideas about white unity and white unity working, people being on code. But it doesn't seem necessary. You can make a lot of change with just a few people. You actually don't need all the people.
Authoritarianism it is.
There we go.
So you're not a Black unitist? Unitist.
Unitarian?
I'm not.
I like unitist.
Unitarian.
Unitarian Black Aversalist.
Black Aversalist.
The only church I attend.
Black How unity. Are we going to fight white unity if we don't have Black unity, Toussaint?
Is there white unity?
There is no white unity.
What do you call the police?
The police.
Interesting point. I'm not making this up. 1968 Black Power Conference, I believe, or 69. One of the co-sponsors was the New York Police Department.
Really? Were they hiring more Black people?
Maybe. And, you know, I mean, some of the things that some of these first Black mayors did was get more Black police officers hired or Black police, you know.
But that was the cry for years. It's been the cry for decades. Once we get more Black cops, they'll know who the good Black people are.
Right.
Somebody says they said, Paul, write another hit piece on Marcus Garvey, please. I mean, what a weird thing to get off on.
Well, that's
like, you just love for these people that you think are like supermen. That's pretty awesome.
Oh, please destroy more of the ethos of the Black consciousness.
Please, Paul.
I mean, just only loosely related to Garvey, but I didn't get to jump in on that internationalist point, but I do wish there was more of that. I mean, you and I, Jason, have talked about this, but just with like with Gen Z folks, like just how much, including Black and Brown Gen Z, just how much they bought into what I have to call like a conscious capitalism approach to just about every fucking thing. I mean, every February when people do, it's all over Instagram and TikTok, will be support Black businesses, support Black creators, support Black this. And you look at the businesses or their fashion brands or whatever they're doing, and there's no real international lens. So many of these things, it's like it's the same fast fashion, it's the same exploitative labor. It has no other concerns other than hand money to somebody whose skin color looks like yours. And it's just wild to me the lack of concern for what's going on in other countries just under the umbrella of support Black business. That's one example.
Gotta get a
people fit in those other countries are united.
Yeah, you didn't know that? They were united in the sweatshop that made this sweater.
I wish they bled on the thread together. So
you know what I mean?
That's
what makes it special.
I wish people spoke, you know, again, when we're talking about unity, I just wish people spoke in more precise, concrete terms. I mean, someone in the chat, sorry, I don't know who you are. I'm sure you're a good person. But someone said, you know, why should we be doing labor unity when white workers can't stand Black people? I'm like, okay, so you know tens of millions of white workers cannot stand.
I don't know if that's, where have you worked?
Can we see
what you? Archie Bunker factory were you working in where they're like, God damn it, another nigga's working here?
But again, I'm constantly amazed people can speak in these terms about tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of people. It's just annoying and useless to talk to in these ways.
Well, when you're at your tech job and you're like the only Black person there that isn't a security guard and you sit at the lunch table with your team, and February comes around and they all ask you for an anecdote, that's oppression, right? That is supreme oppression. And that's where the hatred comes from.
I was, how do I put it? I mean, it seems like people are pretty against the book, but it was that book on like white rural rage that came out. That was another piece just about how like white poor people, particularly in rural parts of the country, are just, you know, to use that same old phrase, deplorables. And every time I see that, I just think about how, because liberal and democratic, you know, political machines can basically just say like, we don't have to fuck with white poor people at all. That just, how do I put it? Just seems like it just keeps kicking down the possibility of some sort of unity between the poor folks who are all on somewhere left of center. It's just maintaining this idea that every single poor white person is just a racist piece of shit that we shouldn't collaborate with at all. It's such an effective wedge.
I don't know, Bert. You ever been around poor white people?
Half my family.
Dude, same with
how bad it, dude. God damn it. We got to take the half breed again.
I do. Listen, go ahead, Paul.
I'm sorry. I was a shameless plug, but I mean, I'm writing a review for Jackman of a new book by Les Leopold, he's worked with Adolf Reed in the Labor Party and the Labor Institute, called Wall Street's War on Workers. One of the things he does in the book, I mean, taking real empirical data of a lot of surveys, and kind of shows like actually over time, the quote unquote white working class has actually become way more liberal on social issues over the last few decades, and that's kind of an empirical way to track that. Anyway,
does it have to do with their daughters dating more Black men?
Actually, I was hoping not to spoil it, but
spoil the ending.
You know, and it watching more like rap music videos, it's kind of
Dude, I'm a firm believer now that Black people have lost rap. Edgars have taken over rap. In the champagne room, we watched all these horrible videos. Were you on that show too, Son, or was that just me?
I was there. Sea of Edgars.
Oh, there's no black people in sight. You can no longer blame black people for rap music. You can't. You can't. I was longing for the ass eat lady to come back on the screen because it was so horrible.
I'm sure you're always longing for that.
I didn't sound right, but
believe it or not, I wanted her to be.
Believe it or not, I was looking for that ass eating lady.
Bert was like, I'm not going to pay attention to that. I could say something, but I'm going to let that go.
All I gotta say is that Jason Miles, he is a connoisseur of all content having to do with ass eating. It's a thing to critique.
If you want to talk about unity, that is unity, white unity.
I mean, perhaps that is the path. That should be somehow the next slogan for worker unity. Has to somehow capitalize off of this ass eating trend that seems to attract people.
I've seen the mountaintop bird, Cooper. Oh, Lord.
Just with some of the comments, I am surprised how many folks are just flat out white people don't like anyone black, just period. I mean, I'll say for like, you know, South Jersey and Philadelphia, which is like very small areas, like I came across fucking racist people all the time, have them in my family. But I also have seen, you know, what gets written about a lot in unions, which is once people have jobs working together with, you know, other working class people of different groups, unless they are just a virulent racist, they just kind of clicks like, oh, I guess all that shit I saw on TV wasn't really true. These people are different than that. All right. And that's kind of it. Like most, you know, cookouts, everything that I went to on the black side of my family, everybody was working class and they always had at least a few white friends that they fucked with. So, I mean, that's just my personal experience.
Pascal.
I think when you deal with people who actually had union experience, I mean, my mom was a career union, 1199 nurses, hospital union worker. She had to deal with white people all the time. It's part of the experience. So I think that notion that you can escape working with people outside of your race is ridiculous. It's very insular.
Also, so you wouldn't want a bunch of black nurses? Is that what you're trying to say, Pascal?
Black nurses, white nurses.
Black nurses, white nurses.
Also, Pascal, that made me think. Sorry, go ahead, Paul.
Well, I'm saying, I mean, let's say it's true. Let's say all white people hate black people. Mm-hmm. Well, the question is, what are we going to do about it? Are we going to figure out a way to unite working people in, or not, you know, or this exists how we are now? I mean,
when's the war? When's the race war? I mean, if we're gonna start from that posture, then the next question to me is like, okay, good. And that's it. When's the race war?
I mean, from the pop cultural standpoint, what you're saying, Pascal, is kind of like it is the direction that you see a little bit in that the number of people that are getting labeled as white or white adjacent seems to grow every year. So it does seem like the ultimate strategy is, at least in the culture wars, is, well, white guilt worked really well on this segment of the population, identity politics, and making them just kind of feel bad and maybe give us some wins that we want, like a chair at an elite college. So we're going to expand the circle of people who should also feel like they're white. We should include Asians in that, any light-skinned Hispanic people, and they should all equally feel the guilt and give us chairs in elite positions. But that's the strategy, is just expand how many people should think of themselves as white or white adjacent, and then they should do what, you know, white liberal females have done and feel bad about it, D'Angelo style.
But there's a contradiction, because, I mean, if they're going to do that, then you got to get rid of terms like BIPOC, but they also don't want to do that. So they always want to do both things at the same time. Even if
just learned what that was not too long ago, by the way.
What do you think it meant?
What it sounded like.
Which is?
I thought it was a bisexual person of color.
I mean, that's very rational.
I thought it was a bisexual person of color.
It's very rational.
I was wrong.
Because we know what your first instinct is there, buddy.
I don't stand for it because it erases Black Indigenous people, so. I'm at the frontier.
Thank you guys so much for hanging out with us. Thank you very much, panel. Bert, Paul, Pascal, Ellen Chisholm, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm not going to make that a character. I'm just going to call you that and then run away.
Appreciate it.
No problem. Because I can't have you hit me. I think you're ambidextrous.
5'3" and ambidextrous. I'm slowly piecing together. 5'3" ambidextrous. 5'3" Haitian
with long, with long hair.
Throws both hands with accuracy.
When she switches southpaw on me, I'm like, oh, shit, I'm done for.
Today, you got something coming for you.
See? When she's mad. When her and Pascal get mad, all the New York comes out of them. I love it.
I'm just happy to know that you've got no defense for a southpaw. So throw less. No,
I'm not ready for it. I'm not ready for it at all. Once I see that stance, I'm like, oh, you know what? Just here's the wallet. Whatever you need.
Here's the wallet.
I wasn't that close with that woman. You guys look like a good couple. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Here's the cardigan.
Oh, no. We'll fight for the cardigan. We'll fight for the cardigan. You can take the wallet, but I need this.
And that's all I have on walking home. Fuck happened to you? Some left-handed nigga wanted to fight, and I'm just not trying to take that ass whooping tonight. Thank you guys so much. Again, there should be a link in the chat to Paul's piece. There will definitely be a link in the comments after this show. There'll be a link in the description, the audio-only podcast of this show. If you're new to the show and you enjoyed what you heard, if you didn't enjoy what you heard, you have a comment, definitely leave it. Toussaint's going to read it, relate it back to me, and then we're all going to fight about it later. Thank you guys very much. And we are out.